Well, thank you to the first speaker for introducing the topic. The speaker made some references to the dichotomy between thought and mind, the eye and the heart doctrine, and also surveyed in a way the flow of ideas from West into East and a kind of cross-pollination, if you will, of some of this modern ideas of materialism. In this talk, we'll basically draw out a framework using which we can maybe analyze the situation at hand. So before we do, we should try and use some analogy that we can extend to understand the concepts of how thought and mind work from a theosophical perspective. One analogy that lends itself pretty well for this kind of analysis is to think of thoughts as seeds and the mind as soil. If you take a piece of soil that is within the precincts of your, light on the path says, the piece of ground that you think is you and you control it, as long as you think it is, you identify with it, then you are responsible for what grows in that soil. Thoughts are like, and ideas are things that usually come in from the outside. Now, you may read certain thoughts, you may watch it on some video in YouTube and things like that these days. You may even think you have come up with a novel thought yourself, but there's nothing new under the sun. All such thoughts are recurring impressions, seeds that come in from the outside, that fall on the soil, and you determine which of these come up, sprout, and become trees, and form the garden of your mind space, if you will, and which you weed out. So if you think of thoughts as seeds and mind as soil and use that on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis, if you have Eastern and Western, you have essentially a two by two grid where you have Eastern thought, Western thought, Eastern mind, Western mind. Let's simply analyze each of these in the current situation as it stands, and then see what the consequences of the current situation is as it stands. So let's first start with Western thought. Now, William Q. Judge, when describing Western and Eastern ideas and thoughts, in his article, The Truth About East and West, uses the analogy of a wave of evolution, an evolutionary impulse. And the crest of that wave used to be in India many thousands of years ago. The achieved heights of philosophical thought and heights of moral and ethical living. The society was of a golden age. Those are recorded. Some of the extant scriptures that we see, itihasas, also hold and give us glimmers of that long forgotten and lost glory days of India. That crest of evolutionary crest moved on to Europe. Europe had its rise, had its enlightenment. And William K. Judge is quite explicit in saying that that wave of evolution and the crest of that wave of evolutionary cycle is now in America. It is that land in theosophical teaching where there is a cauldron of races coming in and mixing. There is almost a gladiatorial clash of ideas and ideals. in that furnace, if you will, of human activity and fervent thought, theosophy says that it is forming, we are forming the next stage of human evolution, that of the sixth sub-race. Now, at the outset, it is important to state that it is not an imminent outcome. It is not that the current Americans are sixth sub-race people, or even those who will follow them in the immediate generations. HPB has been very explicit in her statements, especially in an article that is in the book, Theosophical Articles and Notes, under the title, The Secret Doctrine and Its Study, that the sixth subrace is many hundreds of years in the future. I think that she's very explicit about that because there are many hundreds of years in the future, because there is a very, there is a trap of falling into this kind of race purity and racism very easily. And so I think HPB has been very careful to make that point explicit. So when we say largely Western mind, we mean that mind which is being prepared now in the American soil. So when we say Western thought, let's look at the prevailing ideas that are ongoing in that continent and some of the implications of those thoughts. So if you look at the American thought right now, you largely find one class of ideas that are, you can say, the overhang from the Dark Ages. Essentially, ideas from Christianity that have remained and survived the Enlightenment upheavals, right? It has also gone through a Protestant Reformation, and yet the fundamental ideas remain. So the Protestant Reformation and the many divisions of Protestant ideas that still remain in America can be largely called Calvinist, coming from a teacher that existed some time ago whose name was Calvin. This Calvinist ideas essentially posit five dogmas, which are the acronym of which is TULIP. We'll quickly go through that to survey the at least some portion of the population that hold these ideas. TULIP stands for T, stands for total depravity. Essentially, it's a form of original sin. It means that they're claiming that human nature in every form is depraved and you're born in sin. This is the idea of original sin. U stands for unconditional election. It means that God in his infinite mercy and grace and sovereign will chooses certain souls that he creates for salvation. Why he chooses some and not others, we don't know. But unconditionally, he chooses some for salvation. The others are condemned to damnation. Unconditional election. U. L stands for limited atonement. So while Calvinists claim that Jesus died on the cross to atone for the sins of humanity, that atonement is limited. Conditions. It is not infinite. It didn't redeem all of humanity. So limited atonement. T-U-L-I stands for irrepressible grace, meaning for those selected, elect, who God has chosen, he has irrepressible, irresistible grace that he covers on these people. And finally, the last P stands for the perseverance of saints, of the elect, meaning no matter what obstacles come in their way, they use language like the power of the Holy Spirit will surmount all obstacles to lead these people to deliverance, right? This is the kind of dogma that exists and has been politicized and largely today spoken of as like a kind of metaphysical basis for certain right-wing ideology. With the Enlightenment values, the fetters that Christianity and church had placed on Europe were finally cast aside, right? And the fetters were real. There is this story about Galileo, which truly exemplifies how those fetters were made of iron. So apparently Galileo, when he saw through his telescope, you know, rightfully concluded that we live in a heliocentric solar system. And then he propounded those theories, which goes against the geocentric ideas that the church at that point had. So Galileo, apparently, the inquisitors came to his house, politely took him to the church and showed him the instruments of torture. And then Galileo prudently kept his mouth shut for the rest of his life. That's how much of an iron shackles the church had on the mind of the Western civilization. When those shackles were burst asunder, they went from dogmatic presuppositions all the way to the other end with three ideals of the Enlightenment, which we can consider. So idea one was that of reason and logic, right? This is a very good idea, meaning that we will use rigorous logic and our God-given reason to navigate the natural world, to study it, and to use it to advantages so as to uplift the well-being of humanity, which has largely been successful. I mean, the modern conveniences of a flushing toilet and penicillin and these things would be considered magic 100 years ago. So those have been largely the success of science and technology in that realm as testament to the fact that those have yielded results. Reason. Two, liberty. Because church had placed such a stranglehold on the free-thinking mind, the ideas of liberty were extremely, vociferously put forward. Freedom of speech, freedom of conscience. Your individual liberty is infinite to the point where it doesn't abut on the individual liberty of another person, right? So this is the idea of liberty. Finally, the idea of progress. Where before, what was considered progress was what was in the church doctrine, which is to say, you know, you were working towards salvation, you're making confessions, whatever it may be. There were some, are you following the Ten Commandments or not? With progress, what the Enlightenment age came up with was to say, we reject all such dogma and we will determine for ourselves what progress means. What is well-being mean? What does good mean? What one ought to do is up to us, right? So progress was defined as greater, you know, comforts, greater access to technology, longer life, whatever it may be. Now, while these three ideas were at the time redemptive, it burst forth the encapsulated mind from the dogmas of church, have since then been degraded. And look at the degradation. First, the idea of reason. Reason, logic alone does not give you a ground on which to stand. You have to have axioms on which you start working, right? When you reject all presuppositions, what you stand on is what you see and hear and touch your senses. So reason and rationality has degraded into materialism, which the previous speaker spoke about. Liberty. To understand how liberty has degraded, you have to use Sanskrit terms here. So in Sanskritam, the best translation for liberty would be Swatantra. Swatantra, Swatantra. Tantra means control, Swatantra means self-control. But that is not the idea of liberty that we have today. It is Swetta. You do what you please is considered liberty. Self-control would be the very opposite of what people would consider liberty today. Your ability to follow every whim, fancy is considered liberty, not the ability to control yourself to lead a path that you find to be righteous. that is not even considered close to liberty. Let's look at progress. When you're left without a metaphysical basis on which to ground ethics, you have all these competing ideas of utilitarianism, of deontological ethics, of emotivism. Philosophy is replete with all of these isms. None of them give any answers. And basically, there is a crisis of meaning in the West, right? So on the one hand, you have this Calvinist, you know, the five dogmas, the hangover from the Dark Ages. On the other hand, you have these ideas of enlightenment that have degraded. That's the Western thought. Let's look at Eastern thought. You can go to ends of India and you'll find these three ideas that most people generally hold. And those ideas are, one, mukti. Mukti is liberation. Everybody largely hold that this life is odious and is full of cares and concerns and suffering. And to be liberated from this conditioned existence is the teleological purpose. Whether people are truly committed to walking that path or not is different, but they hold this idea. This idea exists of mukti, liberation. But in this path of liberation, you have placed obstacles by yourself through the act of karma, the law of ethical causation. Your previous actions have led to certain circumstances and effects that place obstacles in your path, karma. Three, punarjanma or reincarnation. Not only are the karmic effects from this life, but from previous lives, and also in lives to come. So you're in the cycle of birth and death, which is shackled, in which you are shackled due to the persistence of karma and its concatenation of cause and effects. And to break free from this is mukti, and that is your teleological purpose. These three ideas largely exist in the East. Now let's look at the Western and Eastern minds, the soil, if you will. These are the seeds that we have surveyed. Let's survey the soil. William K. Judge makes a very, very pertinent observation when he talks about the Western mind. He calls it vigorous and eager, full of energy, looking for ideas, looking for answers. It is unencumbered by superstition and preconceived notions largely. We see that it is largely scientific, critical thinking, inquiry. It is, if you compare it to soil, it's almost like it's a well-tilled soil with a lot of inbuilt nutrition in it, right amount of moisture. It's highly malleable, a lot of fecundity, possibilities in it. Let's survey the Indian mind or the Eastern mind largely. I mean, since we're in India, let's look at the Indian mind. What do you find? And William K. Judge puts his finger on the nub when he says that the Indian mind is largely superstitious when not exposed to the Western ideas, the salutary influences of the Western ideas. You find that across the board. It's like soil that has calcified and become rocky. It is not malleable to new ideas. It is not critically thinking. It doesn't have enough nutrition. It's almost like the energy is sapped from it. And even in those minds which have been exposed to certain Western ideas, where that calcification has been broken down and made more malleable, the seeds that have fallen on the soil is unfortunately the degraded ideas of the Enlightenment. In Indian urban, middle and upper class societies, you largely find the ideas of materialism, which is the degraded idea of reason. You'll find swechha, I do what I please, as a concept of liberty. And lastly, of I set my own standards, like moral relativism, right? There is no standard but the standard I set. That's the tragedy. Now that we've surveyed this, what has largely happened is the Western thoughts have taken root in Western mind and are blossoming forth in various ways. in Eastern thought, in Eastern mind, with the Western transplants, right? And we see really bad results coming out of all of this. Let's survey the results, right? Let's take one example. Just take jurisprudence, for example. In the West, there is this retributive, capital punishment heavy jurisprudence. Why? Just take the ideas that they have. If you look at the Calvinist idea of total depravity and eternal damnation, if there is an evil person that has done some evil, if you put that person to death, all that you're doing is you're hastening that person's eventual sojourn into hell. And once they go to hell, you've cleaned out earth. They are there eternally. So killing them makes total sense. Take the materialistic idea. It says the exact same thing, that evil is the outcome of the biochemical processes of the body. And if you put an end to the biochemical processes by killing it, you put an end to evil. So in both ideas, capital punishment makes total sense. Whereas, what is the truth? What does theosophy teach? That evil is the outcome of the skandhas produced by that individual and the collective skandhas of society, which don't die by the killing of that one body in which it is finding its expression, but rather those skandhas that was so far constrained by the physical constraints of the body is now liberated from it. That skandhas, those set of evil skandhas that had at least some salutary influence of the higher self has now been separated from it. And it is now in its own realm, way more potent, way more active, and way more, has more ability to influence and wreak havoc on society. And that's why, you see, in societies with capital punishment, there is a proliferation of crime in society. So what this shows is bad ideas lead to bad outcomes. So what is the solution here, right? And this is why theosophy was given to the world, so that the universal ideas that existed everywhere, it was prolific, it was all around the world, in every culture, in every peoples. Unfortunately, or through the karmic course of events, in all other cultures and countries, except India, that universal wisdom has not persisted. India, as it so happens, you can say larger India, including Tibet, and still retain the store grain. It became the storehouse of those ancient ideas. Now, theosophy is given to re-energize those ideas. And Vilimpi just makes a very, very important point here. Theosophy was given in English, not in Sanskritam. Why? It was given for the right people. So re-energize those ideas, reformulate them in a way that is most suited for the Western mind to assimilate it, and for those seeds to be planted on this nutritious soil that is being prepared in America and Aryanize the Western mind, so that the sixth sub-race that is being formed and through the cauldron of mixtures and the furnace of the clash of ideas, that these seeds would then be part of that furniture and will bring forth the new type of humanity on a higher, more spiritual standing. P.P. Wadia, in his article Cultural Units, which is in this pamphlet that we have called Will the Soul of Europe Return, says that it is the responsibility of what he calls vanguard cultural units of both East and West to accomplish this end for which those who watch over humanity have given us theosophy. Now, today is the holy day of Shivaratri. it's the 14th day of the dark fortnight of the month of Maghamasa. And there are many stories as to why we celebrate Shivaratri. One of the stories is that today is the day that Shiva, Purusha, married Parvati or Prakriti. So today, we can use this symbology to say that the Purusha aspects of the Eastern thought, when married with the more vigorous, eager minds of the West, would bring forth, as B.P. Wadia says, the sixth ray is the new type of humanity on a higher, more spiritual plane. That we can use this analogy of thought, mind, seed, soil, to say that the winning combination in that 2x2 grid is not Western thought on Eastern mind. We have tried that. We already have that in most, like we said, Indian, urban, middle class, upper class household, does not give good outcomes. Western ideas of these Calvinist ideas with the degraded enlightenment values, even on a good soil as the Western mind, doesn't give good results. It is only the combination of the ancient Eastern ideas now enlivened through theosophy in the Western mind that is the winning combination. That is the marriage of Purusha Prakriti, as it were, that is the most propitious for the future of humanity. So having said that, we will end and open the floor up for any questions, comments, or further additions to what has already been said.
Despite the Chinese stranglehold on the minds of the Christian populace, there must have existed some knowledge in theosophical sense concerning the spiritual nature of man. Of course, that might have been smothered. Did any such ideas prevail over and above churches' misdemeanors?
During the Dark Ages, were there any
survived to our day, I mean.
Like, were there a cabal of adepts who kept the light, even in Europe, alive? I believe there was. Mount Athos, we are told, is one such in Greece. There is another mention of, I forget, do you remember? From Druses and Lamas, or one such article. In, so the Druses and Lamas. Druses and Lamas, I think. The Druze are supposed to be.
Gnostics.
Gnostics may be another one. Are supposed to be. And even when we say Druze or Mount Athos, it may not be the exoteric what we see now, but there is probably an inner school in each of these places that have preserved the knowledge.
There's always a Hellenic bridge and thoughts from Egyptian thought did in fact influence the Western mind. We had Pythagoras, Socratic thought, Platonic ideas, which formed a bridge, as it were, from the East towards the West, Hellenic ideas.
Right.
The Islamic Age of Enlightenment had Sufis who maintained a mystic link. And probably some of the scholars were quite scientific in their outlook also. Among the Islamic Enlightenment era.
Took the initiative of studying and encouraging the line of thought of the movement. Is that a part of Islam?
They call it the golden age of Islam, meaning when Islam went and conquered most of the Byzantine and Greco-Roman areas, they came into possession of Platonic and Neoplatonic texts that they translated into Arabic and studied, and led to a kind of golden age, which also ended by some unfortunate misinterpretation, or shall we say, draconian interpretations of Islamic scripture, which persists to this day.
Probably it was an opportunity for the formation of Islam, but it didn't come through.